we can get started and people can join in as if they drag in while we're on the way. This would be a time to try and tie up some loose ends. I had started going over on Tuesday and Wednesday. I had gone over some specific over-the-counter remedies. I didn't get through the whole list, and I thought we can work our way through them and then take a few minutes to talk about homeopathy. It shouldn't take a real long time to do homeopathy. And then if we do get to it, I've got a list of some of the, what I think are the more popular and famous myths that are associated with non-prescription medications, and we can talk about them. So, you had been talking, Judy, about arthritis, and got me to thinking that there's not much in the over-the-counter realm for the treatment of arthritis, osteoarthritis, certainly not rheumatoid arthritis, but the kind of arthritis that most of us get is osteoarthritis. And so we'll talk about that for a minute and skip down through remedies for acid indigestion, laxatives, antidiarrheals, and so on in probably, hopefully, just a few minutes. The problem with osteoarthritis is that there's really no easy path for treatment of this malady. The most widely used drugs are probably the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like aspirin and ibuprofen, and then prescription level non-steroidals as well. And the problem with the over-the-counter drugs is that aspirin and ibuprofen and Aleve have not been approved by the FDA for the high dosage that is required to treat the inflammation. It can treat the pain, but it can't treat the inflammation except at very high doses. And these doses are ones that, as I mentioned last night, as you increase dosage, the incidence of side effects goes up. And so it's really not a, as far as over-the-counter drugs are concerned, there's not a lot out there. And that makes arthritis, osteoarthritis, sort of a poster child for exploitation. Anybody who comes up with a concoction that they want to promote as a cure for arthritis is free to do so. Shark cartilage was one of these, and we went through that that phase, and thankfully that's fallen by the wayside. But given the lack of regulation for dietary supplements, anybody can come up with something, and where you usually see these ads are in the newspaper. Some of these people will buy a full page ad in the newspaper, and this is a big wonder cure for arthritis or backache or what have you, but you know, they never tell you what's in it. And these are things best avoided. One thing that is available on the market is glucosamine alone or in combination with chondroitin. And these are substances that stimulate the production of the components of cartilage. Glucosamine comes from shellfish. Chondroitin, I think, is just synthesized. They're two distinctly different molecules, but they do basically the same thing here. The hope is that people who would take these things would find that it not only relieves the pain and inflammation of arthritis, but it actually builds and sustains cartilage. The good here that we can associate with glucosamine especially is that there is some relief of pain for some people. And these things, they're just components of cartilage. There are really not any significant side effects that have been reported at the doses that people would take. But the reality here is that there's no current evidence that these things will prevent the loss of cartilage, which is the real problem, or that the combination of the two is superior to simply to glucosamine alone. The problems with glucosamine The main problem with glucosamine is allergy because it's of shellfish origin. So if people are allergic to shellfish, then they're probably going to be allergic to glucosamine. Chondroitin can cause gastric irritation and nausea, and if that's a problem and somebody thinks that the glucosamine is helping, then they can stick with just simply with glucosamine. I've stuck in a slide here, a couple slides about agents that are used to treat heartburn and acid indigestion and that sort of thing, principally because that arena in the, over-the-counter market has been revolutionized in the last several years. Up until that time, basically what we had were antacids for neutralizing stomach acid, and these are effective. They will relieve upset stomach, they will relieve acid indigestion, upset stomach of the sort that would lead you to have nausea and be a signal to maybe that the stomach flu is coming on, isn't helped a whole lot by the antacids. But there was a variety of these things out there. The old standard, of course, is good old Arm & Hammer sodium bicarb, which is basically what Alka-Seltzer is with some aspirin thrown in, sodium bicarbonate and aspirin. Tums and Rolaids contain, for the most part, calcium carbonate, and then the big-ticket items that you find in the stores, Maalox and Mylanta and so on, usually are a combination of aluminum and magnesium hydroxide, and it's a combination because aluminum is a constipating agent, and magnesium is a loosening agent. And so the objective here in combining them is to not upset things too badly, and for the most part that is the way it works.
Question: where does milk of mag hit?
Milk of magnesia is magnesium hydroxide.
Okay.
And so if you take milk of magnesia by itself, you're taking a laxative.
Yeah.
Okay. But it also would work for acid indigestion.
I'm a nurse and we use it to blow people out. So
yeah.
I was curious where it was.
Right. Yeah, it does that.
Is that how you express it to them? We're going to blow you out today.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of ways we refer to these unseemly aspects of.
They're happy when it's
Yeah, they're happy.
They don't mind what you call it.
Right. But where the industry has changed here in the recent years has been the development of drugs that actually will prevent the secretion of stomach acid. And excess stomach acid is what is behind this whole business of acid indigestion. And the first ones on the market in around 1995 were called histamine 2 receptor blockers. And these are antihistamines that are not effective for treating allergies. It's a different receptor that histamine interacts with to cause allergic phenomena, but histamine is also a very powerful stimulant of stomach acid secretion. And so we've got a whole variety of drugs that first came out as prescription drugs, and then they were around for a few years before this time. But then it was realized how effective they were and how relatively safe they were, and so the drug companies jumped on the opportunity to put them into the over-the-counter market, and they're making a blue fortune selling these things. But that's not even the end of it, because another class of drugs, the so-called PPIs or proton pump inhibitors, were developed after the turn of the century. Prilosec and Prevacid are the only two currently that are in the over-the-counter realm. These are exceedingly effective as well in shutting down the secretion of excess stomach acid. And there are others in the over-the-counter market. There's Pepto-Bismol, which contains bismuth subsalicylate. It's a coating agent. It doesn't do anything to stop the production of acid, but it protects the stomach lining to a certain degree from the irritation that can be caused by the acid. The general consideration for the use of these things on an over-the-counter basis is that no one should use any one of these for more than 14 days in a row. If your acid indigestion continues, or you've got pain, pain in your stomach region, then this would signal that there's something more of a more serious nature going on, and you should see a physician. As I'll point out, there are ample opportunities as well with these drugs for drug interactions to occur with other drugs, specific, more importantly, with prescription drugs that people would be taking on a day-to-day basis. With the antacids, there's one particular thing that's worth pointing out. The liquid forms of the antacid are much more effective than tablets, because what is happening here is the way these antacids work is that the smaller the particle size of the antacid, the better able it is to combine with acid in the stomach. And the manufacturer, in making a liquid antacid, can grind the powder to a much finer consistency than we can with our teeth, with the tablets. And so while tablets and liquids are both effective, the liquids are far more effective. They give a greater reduction of acidity, and will sustain it for a little longer period of time. But then the antacids are notorious for having an effect to alter the absorption and even the elimination of other drugs by changing acid-base circumstances, both in the stomach itself as well as internally. Sodium bicarbonate, for example, will change the acid-base balance slightly of the blood. The H2 receptor blockers, such as Pepcid, their main claim to fame is that they will shut down very effectively nighttime acid secretion, which is a big problem for folks who have ulcer conditions, and we tend to secrete a lot of acid during the night for some reason, and the H2 blockers seem to be more selective for that part of the acid secretion phenomenon, whereas the others aren't. The effects of the antacids are relatively short-lived. They're only effective until they have sopped up as much acid as they can sop up, and then eventually they're going to be expelled from the stomach anyway into the intestine, where there isn't a problem. The proton pump inhibitors are slow to come on in action. So these are not drugs that you would take if you get up from a heavy meal and you're burping and you've got some acid indigestion and some gastric reflux. The PPI isn't going to help you there. It takes several days for the full effect of this to come on. But once it's on, then you've got basically around the clock protection for as long as you take the drug. And then when you stop taking one of these drugs, it takes several days for the effect of it to go away, because it has actually tied itself up with the mechanism that produces the acid. With the Pepto-Bismol, the important thing here to mention is that if you have an allergy to aspirin, then you don't want to take this, because bismuth subsalicylate is a salicylate. It's related to aspirin. Just a couple words about laxatives. There was a time 10 or 20 years ago when, well, even longer than that, I can remember when I was a kid, when the radio shows were being sponsored by Saritan and Nature's Remedy, and it was all about regularity. And if you weren't regular in your bowel habits, then you weren't normal. And everyone wants to be normal, and so to be normal, you get regular, and that was the pitch. And we don't hear it so much anymore, but it's been the pitch up until really into the 90s, and we still do hear it a bit. The reality of this, of course, is that we all have our own bowel habits. And for some, there are frequent bowel movements in the course of a day, and then others, there are just two or three during the course of a week. And it doesn't really matter. Your intestines know what they're doing, and they will take care of things under ordinary circumstances. However, if there is a legitimate need for a laxative, in the over-the-counter market, all of the laxatives that are available to physicians are available over-the-counter. but not all of them should be used, because some of them are just flat violent. The saline and the stimulant laxatives, the kinds of things that the doctor would give you to prep you for a colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. When I talk to the medical students about these, I put these letters up here, and they wonder what that means. And I say, well, for these, what this stands for is don't stray too far from the toilet. Because these things will make you a walking time bomb. And they're best avoided on the over-the-counter market. There are gentler ways to get this thing accomplished. The stool softeners are available, but the best ones really for the over-the-counter world are the bulk-forming laxatives, just vegetable laxatives. Psyllium seed is really what it is, and what you do is you take a slurry of this stuff in a bunch of water, you drink it down, and when it gets into the intestine, it absorbs water, it forms a bulk within the intestine that stimulates the normal physiologic action of the intestine, and it moves things along. And usually that's all that's necessary to get things going. The best option is to avoid constipation, and you can't avoid it completely. You change your diet, you change your locale, you go on vacation and things are different, and your intestines tend to reflect that to a certain degree. But as long as you drink plenty of fluid, as long as you eat your vegetables, your bulk-forming sorts of things, and you just be patient, your normal intestinal activity will resume.
I'd add walking to that.
And walking, yeah, excellent. I'll put that on the list. But the next best option, as I mentioned, is Metamucil or one of these fiber-based laxatives. The only precaution that's really important here to be considered, well, two. One is these can interfere with the absorption of drugs, and so if you've got chronic medication that you're taking, you need to be sure that that this isn't going to interfere with the absorption of the drug. If it is, then you take the drug at times that you're not taking the laxative. And the other is to be sure that you drink plenty of water, because the only real hazard here with one of these things is that you don't drink enough water, and this thing will form a very hard, solid mass that could then be impossible for the intestine to move it along. And when that happens, you've got a serious problem. Yeah?
Where does caffeine and coffee kind of fit in here?
Caffeine is a diuretic, and in some people, I don't know whether it's the caffeine or it's something else in the coffee that will stimulate intestinal activity, but some people will find
that
coffee kind of loosens them up.
It does.
Yeah, but really, the pharmacologically, caffeine, if it's anything, it's a stimulant and a diuretic to cause urine production.
Okay.
We can always talk a little bit about diarrhea, the opposite problem. And really the big one for most folks is traveler's diarrhea. You know, if you're in Mexico, it's Montezuma's Revenge. And if you're in Russia, it's the Trotskys. And there are all sorts of things for it. There are remedies here that are more or less effective. One that's probably the least effective, been around for a very long time, is so-called kaolin suspension. This is, again, a vegetable matter remedy that absorbs water when you get it into the gut, and it does the same kind of thing that a Metamucil product would do. It's something that you're cautioned not to use it in children. I'm not sure why that is, but that's one of the cautions. Pepto-Bismol actually was shown in clinical trials to be effective for relief of traveler's diarrhea, and so folks often are encouraged to just take a bottle of tablets. You don't need the liquid necessarily. The tablets are very convenient to travel with, and you can get it through security with no problem.
Straight in Mexico.
But it's something you don't want to use in children because it's of the salicylate content and the danger of Reye syndrome in susceptible children and teens associated with the salicylate. The most effective drug, which has come on the market here, it's been a number of years now, but is Imodium, known as loperamide. This actually inhibits the motility of the gut, slows the gut, gives the gut time to absorb the water that's in there and that's contributing to the loose stools. And it's of all of these, this is probably the most effective. People are cautioned not to use it if you have a fever, but it is considered safe for children in half dosage. And I see it with a half parentheses too. And so, you know, in the context where you're dealing with traveler sorts of diarrhea, these things can be helpful. If your diarrhea is associated with the flu, then this probably isn't going to help a whole lot. It might help a little bit, but you're probably just doomed to have to live through it, and then it'll get better on its own. Over-the-counter weight loss aids in past years were a big deal, but the FDA has kept taking these things off the market because they contain drugs related to amphetamine, for the most part, because amphetamine is an appetite suppressant and does help in certain situations where people are trying to lose weight. But we don't have any of products now in the conventional realm that contain anything related to amphetamine. We've got one here, it's called Orlistat. It's fairly recently added to the over-the-counter list. And this is an agent that actually inhibits enzymes that digest fat and put it into a form in the intestine that can be absorbed. And so you whatever fat you consume in your diet just gets lost in the stool. And this is a very effective way for folks who are really serious about losing weight and are cutting down their caloric intake. This is a very effective aid in some cases for weight loss. It doesn't come without cost. There's a problem of interactions. Drugs, by their very nature, are soluble in fat, and if you've got a lot of fat that's staying in the gut and you're taking drugs along with this, they may not be getting absorbed as effectively as they might. There are digestive issues that would be associated with not being able to absorb fat, and folks who have digestive issues associated with their gallbladder, actually it's digestive issues that can contribute to the development of kidney stones, and so on, should not be taking this agent. Folks who are taking this thing on a regular basis should be taking vitamins A, D, and K because these are the fat-soluble vitamins, and this will limit the absorption of these vitamins. And then there are some cosmetic issues associated with having undigested fat in your stool. It's just you're losing very fatty feces and there are just cosmetic issues associated with that. So this drug is not without its problems. If someone was to come to me and ask about this, I would say, sure, this might be helpful, but talk to your doctor. And if you are really want to get on a program where you're going to lose some weight, and this might help you, work this out with a physician or a dietitian or some such person. There are a number of unapproved drugs that are on the market, but these are not in the conventional over-the-counter realm. This is in the dietary supplement realm. Ephedra used to be on the market. It's gone. The FDA removed it because it's related to amphetamine and was causing too many problems. People actually die from overdoses of ephedra. And so it's gone. But there's a relative of it still available in the form of bitter orange, herbal preparation, synephrine, and it causes the same kinds of things that ephedrine would cause. And I don't think it's going to be too long before the FDA takes action on this one as well and prevents its sale in the dietary supplement market. And then there are products on the market now that have shifted, so they can't use ephedra anymore, they've gone to caffeine. Caffeine has an interesting property that it will in fact promote some burning of calories. It increases basal metabolic rate to a very small degree. And this fits, if you were here last night and I talked about the half-truth hustle, This fits in that category because it comes in drinks, energy drinks, that are calorie burning. And they'll say, burns, one can will burn 100 calories. And that's true. That's true. That's been shown in clinical studies of caffeine used in this context. The dose of caffeine here is equivalent to 2 to 3 cups of coffee, of what you would find in 2 or 3 cups of coffee. Do you know? Does anybody know how many calories are associated with a pound? How many calories do you have to burn to lose 1 pound of body mass?
3,500.
Right on the money. Wow. It's 3,500.
Class? She's read your book.
Huh?
No. She's read your book.
I don't have a book.
Neither.
She has a book,
but she knew this, and that's good, and that's true. Now, if you drink a can of this stuff a day, and you're only supposed to drink one can of it a day, and if that's all you were doing, you have to drink 35 cans of this over the course of a month to lose 1 pound. So, to me, this is a joke, but nevertheless, it is a selling point for products like this. The bottom line is that there really is no free lunch. I'll come back to this one. We'll talk a little bit about some herbs. But I want to make sure we've got time to talk about homeopathy. That was on the schedule for today. Homeopathy is a practice of medicine that was started by a fellow back in the 18th century. And it's come to us, it started with and has come to us with what amounts to a highly questionable, if not absurd to some people, scientific rationale for why it should even work. Nevertheless, it is practiced and believed in by health professionals and laypersons all over the world, more so even than in the United States. It started in Europe. And it has, and I'll point out, it has a very unique legal status under the U.S. Drug laws. The bottom line for that is that it's essentially unregulated. This was started by a fellow by the name of Samuel Hahnemann, right around the turn of the 18th century. And what homeopathy brings to medicine is something that it deserves honor and accolade for, because it heralded the shift between what we would call heroic medicine, the type of medicine that had been practiced up until that time and going back thousands of years. And by heroic medicine, what I mean is these medicine in those days amounted to the belief that there were evil or bad humors that were causing disease, and that to treat the condition you must get rid of these humors. And so if you took something that was very caustic and blistering and put it on the skin, and pustules would rise up from this, the pustules that would burst and release pus was viewed as the evil humors are coming out of the body. These were the days of bleeding, when physicians would drain huge quantities of blood from patients in an effort to get rid of the evil humors. These were the days of purging, where very severe cathartic laxatives were given that were explosive in their action to clean out the bad humors. And the folklore of those days was, you know, you don't want to be treated by a doctor because the cure is usually worse than the disease itself. Samuel Hahnemann looked at this and said, there's got to be a better way. And he devised this theory of homeopathy, homeo meaning alike or same, and he came up with a notion. I'll come back to the rest of this here. He came up with the notion that really wasn't his idea. This is an old notion that like cures like. He called it the law of similars, and this is the idea that if you had you were vomiting and you just couldn't stop vomiting, then the way to treat that vomiting would be to give you a drug that itself would cause vomiting if you were normal, and we gave you this drug and it caused you to vomit. That's the principle of like cures like. And he came up with a whole list of products or compounds, usually, for the most part, of herbal origin or mineral origin. And he did what he called provings, where he and his associates would actually try these things. We would just take these things and see what kind of symptoms they produced in them. Did it make them sweat? Did it give them a headache? Did it hurt? Did it make give them, were they, did they make their bowels runny and so on? And they would, he would make a note of all this. And so so that when patients would come to these homeopathic physicians now with symptoms, the physician would find out precisely what the symptoms were and through a very elaborate process, and then would choose from his collection of remedies an assortment of herbs that were specific for the symptoms that this individual was showing, and would treat this individual with these remedies, and this would supposedly cure them. Now, there's a this notion of Hahnemann goes a little further, because he came up as well with the law of infinitesimals, in which he said that the potency of a medication increases as a function of how much it has been diluted, rather than how much of it do you give. Increasing amounts, in classical pharmacology, we give increasing doses to get increasing intensity of response. He believed that it goes in the opposite direction. And he said not only that, but you know, he realized that the more you dilute something, the less of it is there, and you get to a point eventually where none of it is there, and in the solution that you are ending up with. But he said what we're really trying to do here is release the innate healing potential of these medicinal substances. And he says the way we do that is that between each dilution, he would do a series of dilutions, 1 to 10 or 1 to 100, 100 in most cases, between each one, we would take our bottle that we have diluted this thing, and then we would tap it on the countertop, and then we would take a small bit of this, and we would dilute it 1 to 10 or 1 to 100 again, and then we would tap it. And this he called this succussion. And this, he believed, was what was releasing the healing power of the drug within that solution. And that, he said, that power remains, even though the drug may be gone. The healing power remains. And what it does is it stimulates healing processes in the body. He referred to this, and in fact, in those days, everyone referred to the idea that there was a vital force, a life-giving force. And the healing philosophies of the world all, for the most part, revolve around a vital force, a prana, a chi. In acupuncture, it's the chi, and so on. These are energy flows through the body. The problem with this, for a modern scientific sort like me, is that their science has no way to test for the presence of this energy force. And in fact, the evidence that has accumulated since people started to study pharmacology and physiology is that we don't have to use this notion of vital force to explain healing processes within the body or physiological processes within the body. And so all of this notion, all of this principle of homeopathy is built on what amounts to a scientific house of cards that is very fragile and is not really consistent with modern scientific approaches to understanding biology and how drugs work. The dilutional phenomenon here, as I mentioned, is associated with tenfold, 100-fold dilutions. So on a product label, you will see a number and one of these letters, an X or a C, and that tells you how many times this thing has been diluted, either by a factor of 10 or by a factor of 100. And if you know your chemistry, you know something about Avogadro's number, which is the number of molecules that are in one mole or one molecular fraction of a chemical substance. So that if you dilute something past 10 to the 24th dilution, then you have no, there was no molecule of the drug remaining there. But to Hahnemann and his followers, this didn't matter because we were dealing with healing energy that has been that had been released.
And the vital force.
And the vital force. Back in the late 19th century, the homeopathic community, and it was huge. In this country, we at its height, we had something on the order of 35 schools of homeopathy. Mm. In fact, the Samuel, there's a medical school still in existence, the Hahnemann School of Medicine in Philadelphia, which was a homeopathic school. It's now a conventional medical school. All of the of those homeopathic schools were gone by, I think, the 1950s or so. Although there are still places where you can be trained in homeopathy, and they've been kind of on the rise in the last 30 years or so.
By conventional, do you mean allopathic? Is that what you mean?
Conventional would be allopathic.
Okay.
Yeah. And in 1938, when the Food and Drug Act was adopted, and in the years leading up to it, there was a senator, Royal Copeland, I think he was from Michigan, who was a homeopath. He was a homeopathic physician. And he just very subtly and very quietly included homeopathic remedies in this Food and Drug Act, and it, they passed, and there was no real issue raised about them, and they are in the United States law, but they are exempt. All of those remedies are exempt from requirements of the Food and Drug Administration that, that safety and efficacy be demonstrated. And one could look at them and say, well, okay, there's really no point in worrying about safety because there's nothing there. And with efficacy, we would also make that argument that if there's nothing there, how can you have a therapeutic effect? Well, I'll come back to this here in just a second, but I'll point out that, that homeopathy has been studied for over 100 years, and there are some pretty good clinical studies that have been applied to it, but what they show, for the most part, is that homeopathy is no better than giving an inactive placebo, a homeopathic remedy. This is controversial because if you look in the homeopathic literature, of course, the many studies there show that these things work like gangbusters. And there are people who absolutely believe this. I'll pass this. What I hear most often, if I'm in a one-on-one discussion with somebody about homeopathy and they happen to be a believer, they will say, yeah, but it works. And you could, and you know, it worked for me, it worked for my Aunt Sadie, and so on and so on. And at that point, I know the discussion is over. But there are ways to explain why a therapy that shouldn't work often does, and this can apply to something like homeopathy. The disease may have run its course. Many diseases are cyclical in that they go through phases where they are intense and then they go away, and then they are intense and they go away. If you take any remedy while you're on the downside of this thing, it would be very simple to make the and obvious to make the conclusion that gee, I started taking this and within about a week my symptoms were all gone. It must have been what I took, when it, that's not necessarily the case. And we know that the placebo effect, the idea that that if you think you are receiving a beneficial treatment, a treatment that will cause something to happen, then we can often measure this response in you, that it actually has happened. I used to do this with my medical students before it became unethical to do this. You can't tell somebody that they're getting a medication when they're really not getting that medication. But I would have an exercise in class. I got 140 students in this class. And I would pass out 140 sticks of gum. And I would say, half of this is regular gum. Half of this contains a drug, atropine, which will dry up your salivary glands. It'll give you a dry mouth. Now we're gonna go through class, I do this at first, at the start of class, and I said, now I want you to raise your hand when your mouth becomes dry. I want to, and I would lie to them, I'd say, we're doing this to illustrate how long it takes for a drug action to occur. And I wouldn't tell them that, well, I would tell them that it's half and half, some of them are not getting the drug. But in reality, none of them are getting the drug. And I did this about three times and in 3 years running. And invariably, I'm going on with my lecture and hands would start going up. And these people were, they were experiencing dry mouth.
What percentage?
Well, I don't know. I think people caught on to this fairly quickly,
yeah.
You know, as we would go. But I would try to not say anything to give it away until I had maybe 20 or 30 people, and we would have them. And so, you know, and then I would say, now what you've just seen is the demonstration of the placebo response.
Mm-hmm.
It's real. And so that's a part of this as well. There's also the notion that people may hedge their bets here. Try homeopathy, try regular medicine, try something else, and take a whole hodgepodge of things for a given condition that they have. When it gets better, they pick one and they say, well, this one did it. And that's the way some of that works sometimes.
Lenny, can I ask a question?
Sure.
About that last one? At the airport, when you go through the big airports, there's a store, and they always have the checkout counter, a product that promises that you won't become ill by breathing that terrible airplane air.
Sure.
They're kind of hedging their bets that they'll, you know, if they take this, they won't get sick.
Sure. And if you take it and you don't get sick, it must have worked, but then everybody else on the airplane didn't get sick either.
That's right. And what is that a homeopathic?
No, that wouldn't necessarily be homeopathic. It might be, I don't know, I'm not familiar with exactly what that
You're
is.
You're just talking about airborne.
Airborne, that kind of stuff.
Well, airborne is not homeopathic, but airborne has been shown to be bogus.
But people will swear by that.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
90% of cure is belief, so.
That's right.
I mean, if you believe
yeah.
in what you're doing.
Believe in the powerful
yeah.
healer.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are several ways then you can explain how something that shouldn't have worked actually seems to have worked. With homeopathy, there is a big difference here between the way homeopathy is practiced and clinical medicine, conventional clinical medicine is practiced. If we go to see our family physician, most of us, in most cases, we're lucky if we spend 10 minutes with them. Okay? With a homeopath, you're lucky if you get out of there in an hour.
Right.
If you're working with a real classical homeopath, that homeopath is going to sit down there and is going to look you in the eye, he or she is going to look you in the eye and is going to run through a whole bunch of stuff, and we're going to talk about all this business, and then he's going to prescribe this medicine that's really going to work for you. There have been a couple of studies that have demonstrated how important that part of the therapy is. And for my money, that's what makes homeopathy work the way that it works. But it also puts the lie to the notion that homeopathic remedies are something that you can just go buy and they're going to work for you. In fact, as it happens, Hahnemann made it very clear when he devised this whole scheme, that you don't let people go out and select their own remedies and make their own dilutions and so on. It's all part of one big package. And to me, that's what sums up the essence of why homeopathy is so popular. The manufacturers of the products, the homeopathic products that get sold on the market, are, in my view anyway, they're just cashing in on this belief that these are effective drugs, just like any of the other drugs that would be on the market. Okay, now, well, we are running kind of short. Let's talk about some any questions about homeopathy?
How many schools are left in the U.S. right now?
I'm sorry?
How many schools are left in the U.S. right now?
None. There are no official schools of homeopathy. The, if you go to the, I never can pronounce the name, but it's a naturopathic school in the state of Washington. They have a course of training that, that will give you credentials in homeopathy. Okay. The, it used to be that you could not be a homeopath unless you were also a an MD. And to their credit, most homeopathic physicians who were MDs knew when to apply homeopathy and when to apply conventional medicine. They knew that they're not going to take care of a patient who's got cancer. They're not going to, homeopathic remedy is not going to cure cancer, and so on. Now, to be trained as a homeopath, anybody can get trained as a homeopath. I'm not sure what that training all entails because I haven't looked at it in that great of detail. But there are, I think there are probably three or four schools that around the country now that, that will graduate you with a degree that says you are a homeopath. Anything else? Well, then let's just touch on a couple of good old myths and misconceptions. One that's that you hear promoted all the time, especially with regard to herbal products and dietary supplements, is that if it's natural, it's superior to synthetic. And there we're talking about in vitamins, for example, that that would be derived from plant materials versus synthesized in the laboratory. And the argument is that because it's from a natural origin, it's superior. You see this claim made all the time. Chemically, this makes no sense. The vitamin molecule that's in the plant is the same molecule that's synthesized in the laboratory. And so so this really is a myth. There's a great one. You can buy bee pollen, and if you go on the web and look for the ads, you know, bee pollen is very high in protein, very nutritious. It is. It's highly nutritious. But who it's really nutritious for is bees. And if you want to get, if you want to use bee pollen as a source of protein supplement for your diet, you would have to consume a lot of bee pollen in order to do that. And it's very expensive. And of course, that's what the manufacturer would like to have you believe. And so bee pollen, true, bee pollen would provide excellent human nutrition, but only in tiny quantities. Then we talked about this last night, the notion that, that herbs, because they are natural, are safe. They cannot harm, all they can do is cure. Well, that's not, neither one of those is true, necessarily. They cannot, they can harm, and they aren't necessarily curative for conditions, especially as we discussed last night, over-the-counter sorts of conditions where you're just treating symptoms of a condition that's going to get better anyway. There's the old one that goes way back, you know, eating carrots will improve your vision. Well, eating carrots will improve your vision if you're in, if your vision is impaired, and it's impaired because you have a vitamin A deficiency. If you do not have a vitamin A deficiency, then carrots, you can eat carrots till you turn orange, and this will not improve your vision. There's the another myth that vitamin C prevents colds. This goes back to Linus Pauling's day, and that was a it was a great notion, and it's a testable hypothesis. It's been tested, and it doesn't hold. Vitamin C can, in for some people, reduce the severity of a cold. That stands to be true, but as far as preventing a cold, the evidence doesn't support that notion. And then there's this one that eat turkey,
oh,
it'll make you sleepy.
True, it does.
The business, the business with yeah, tryptophan. Yeah, the idea here is that turkey supposedly contains huge amounts of L-tryptophan, but it really doesn't contain any more L-tryptophan than any other meat.
Oh.
And what you're probably getting sleepy from is you ate a big meal and maybe drank some wine.
So. Thanksgiving, that's why.
And it's Thanksgiving. Well, the moral of all of this week's story has been you need to be a skeptic about people who are trying to sell you over-the-counter, non-prescription remedies. You should seek reliable sources of information. They're hard to find. I can help you if you're interested. If something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And one very good source, or a source of good information, is a health professional. A pharmacist or a physician in particular could be a good source. And you should insist on this. I tell the medical students, for different reasons, I say, at some point after you've opened your practice, take a pharmacist out to lunch. Make friends with a pharmacist. Because the pharmacist is going to save your bacon one day. And when you have made a mistake on your prescription, and that pharmacist is going to call up and say, I think you meant to say this, then that. Become friends with that pharmacist. Well, the same thing applies for you folks trying to make sense of the over-the-counter drug market, particularly the herbal market. If that's something that interests you, find a pharmacist that knows something about this. And some do. Not all do, but some do. And just shop around. Find somebody who's a pharmacist who's willing to talk to you about these things. I think you'll find pharmacists willing to provide information if they've got the information. And if they're not really up to date on what you're looking for, many of them will get themselves up to date. I would insist on my physician knowing about the herbal remedies that I was interested in taking, and you're free to do this. You're free to ask your physician about these remedies, and he should know something about them. He or she should know something about them. If they don't, then they're embarrassed because they can't answer your question, and maybe they will take the initiative to find something out. But they won't do it unless, you know, the pharmacist isn't going to just pull you aside and start telling you about herbal remedies. The physician won't do that either. You have to ask them, but I encourage you to do that. And nurses too. I mean, there are nurses who are very knowledgeable in the realm of drug therapy, and so if you've got nurses in your acquaintance, in your family, and so on, nail them. You know, ask them about these things. Well, we're out of time, so I think we'll just stop and finish the week here. Thanks for the questions and the attention.